Part 6, Chapter 15, in which Harvey has a whole moment of happiness. Quote, "To fall in love is to create a religion with a fallible God." Jorge Luis Borges, short story, The Meeting in a Dream. As Harvey sailed over the heel of Italy, he gazed down from the airplane with a mixture of sadness and excitement. For though he was looking forward to living the adventures he had just read, he was nervous about the upcoming end. How would his author put a cap on his tale? Would he be slaughtered like the unfortunate Adelphine, casting the universe into the white oblivion of a final empty page? Or would he live, somehow, forever, returning to Part 1, Chapter 1, to begin the reading again? One way or the other, it was time to face his fate. So Harvey turned back to the manuscript and let the words pronounce his sentence. The next morning, Harvey awoke early and went to Arianna's door. When he got no answer, he returned to his apartment. "Gone already?" he sighed. "In her collateral light must I be comforted, and not in her sphere." Remembering she said he could write her, he found a small cafe and started to outline a poem. Everything was clay for his mind, for all things spoke to him, and Arianna was in all things. He listened to the stones, and the trees, and the sky, and each one suggested their own image of perfection. He felt as if he were immersed in a dream, and he wrote wildly, producing 100 poems a day. The only thing that caused him trouble was the memory of Arianna's face. He could not remember her features, for she was all women and no woman. As the days passed, Harvey became more and more involved in the storm of his work. Walking up and down the Via Mazzini, trying rhythms, proposing patterns, and hearing harmonies, he passed the daylight hours tuning his lines, and then, in the evening, he would walk to what he believed to be her father's villa and deliver them. The walk was an inspiration in itself, and many of his poems were born of the sum of its magic, the great bear rising over the hills and river and trees, the cooling air descending, distilling the fragrance of the grasses, and the insects and animals and leaves making their music in the infinite auditorium of the night. As he walked, he would look to the Pleiades and say, "You who were once doves, bearing ambrosia to Zeus, fleeing the fervor of Orion, attend me now as I bear these lyrical doves of my own. Do not hide for shame at entertaining a mortal obsession, but rather follow the fearless Alcyon, who acknowledged no love is greater than the mortal love of her own." Footnote. Merope, the invisible Pleiade, hides for shame at having had intercourse with the mortal Sisyphus. Alcyon, the brightest Pleiade, committed suicide after her husband was drowned by the gods when the couple boasted their love rivaled that of Hera and Zeus. Back to the text. And so Harvey would walk, the sole and proud owner of the night, striding the breadth of the endless earth, until he arrived at the gate of Arianna's home, where he would say, "Heaven is here, and every cat, dog, and mouse, every unworthy thing lives here in heaven, and may look upon Arianna, but Harvey may not." Then he would leave his verses and hurry back, slipping through the fingers of the night, satisfied with the knowledge she would feel his touch by morning. He delivered 14 poems a night for more than 2 weeks without receiving a reply. "Not a single word," he thought, "to settle my soul. Not a single sigh to calm the storm of sighs that I brave for her. Not one moment's mirth for 20 watchful, weary nights." But still he wrote, until one day Mahogany and Idothea came to see him and found his work on the table. "What are these?" said Mahogany, picking up the captain's verses. "Your knees, your breasts, your waist are missing parts of me like the hollow of a thirsty earth, from which they broke off a form, and together we are complete, like a single river, like a single grain of sand.
That's nice, said Idothea, picking up a stack of pages and reading the titles.
In te la terra, la regina, i tuoi piedi, le tue mani, la infinita, se tu mi dimentichi.
Harvey can be in tonight's reading, said Mahogany.
Tonight's reading? Echoed the captain.
At the Roman Theater. Idothea and a group of new poets are going to read there tonight. I may even present something.
I didn't know you wrote, said Idothea.
I didn't, said Mahogany, until a month ago, when I composed a poem for you. I hope you don't mind. I even went on to...
For me? Said Idothea, melting with affection.
It was supposed to be a surprise, but... Mahogany opened his satchel and pulled out a loose-leaf binder that held a dozen short poems, and Idothea opened it to the first one and began to read.
For Judith.
Who's Judith? Said Idothea.
Judith is your pen name, you know, said Mahogany, like Amaryllis, or Beatrice, or Don Quixote's Dulcinea. Every famous courtesan is admired incognito.
Mahogany, said Idothea, you've become so literary.
Well, said Mahogany, I guess I've learned something in the past 200 pages.
But why Judith? Said Idothea.
From the Apocrypha, the Book of Judith. She is the earthly incarnation of piety, beauty, courage, and chastity.
Footnote. The Apocrypha are the early Christian writings which are not included in the New Testament due to their dubious authenticity.
Chastity? Said Idothea.
Well, said Mahogany with a wink, the Book of Judith is an apocryphal book.
Idothea laughed and returned to the poem.
For Judith. Just outside whirl the sparks and the planets in space. Their silver tails leave wounds on the dark glass of the sky. Tonight the moon mounts the slow steps of the spheres, raised like an idol by holy hands, scaling the edge of the night. At the summit the light lingers, awaiting its worldly worship, then descends, riding on ropes, born on the back of the air. Like a white pyramid or a burning crystal, the heavens have been set for you. They light and carry your name to a place beyond the sound of the whistle and whirl of stars.
As soon as she finished reading, Idothea threw her arms around Mahogany. Despite her doubts about the poem's literary merit, she went on to praise it as if it were the most marvelous thing she had ever read. She knew it was the first poem he had written her, and it was from the heart, and she wanted to encourage him to write more. When evening came, the three poets went to the theater. The reading was attended by the most severe critics of Verona and Milano, all of whom had come for the explicit pleasure of ridiculing the innovative artists. Coincidentally, all the poets shared the same name. There was Adelfos Garcia Lorca from Granada, Gustavo Adelfo Becker from Seville, Adelfos Prévert from Paris, the twins Adelfos and Adelfos Young from Salt Lake City, and the tragic-looking Adelfonio Leopardi from Milano. Suddenly, inexplicably, they had all developed the same style at the same time. When they gathered in front of the stage, they felt an immediate kinship with the captain, and they insisted that he do the opening declamation. His friends clapped loudly when Harvey took his place on the stage, and they continued to applaud until Harvey began to read. Clearly and quietly, like a light in the heavens, Harvey's voice was carried to his listeners. It touched all the corners of the universe, interpreting the joys and ecstasies of the audience, and translating them into words that were as immediate as the voice of their own souls in thought. He read on for more than 14 minutes, and when he was finished, the listeners roared their approval. The other poets were equally effective, and after the reading, the critics were raving about the new style. "But what can we call it?" said one. "How about Dolce Stil Nuovo?" "No, no, no," said a critic. "That's already been used." "How about Dolce Stil Vecchio?" "But there's nothing old about it," said another, "except as it reflects the best of the masters." "Yes, that's it. We'll call it Dolce Stil Specchio."
Footnote. Sweet new style, sweet old style, sweet mirror style. There are three schools of criticism that have commented extensively on the work of Captain Harvey. They are the degurgitationists, the new neuterists, and the wisdomists, represented by Jack Lacking and Jacques Mérida, Julie and Hunk Hathaway, and Benedict Cruz y Pelayo, respectively. Lacking and Mérida began their critical work in France under the rare tutelage of the famous Pierre Renard. Their first book, If It Doesn't Move, Decorate It, received little attention in their native France and was scoffed at in Italy, Germany, and Spanish-speaking countries around the globe. If it had not gained immediate fame in the United States, it might have been consigned forever to oblivion. Their second work, The Purveyor of Purveyorism, was heralded as an even greater achievement than their first. The text that concerns us here is their virtually incomprehensible Le sexe comme trop et les tropes comme sexe dans les vers du capitaine par Jackson Quintilius Harvey. This work has also been widely acclaimed in the United States, though the adventures of Captain Harvey themselves have been scoffed at. A contemporary of Lacking and Mérida, J. Raisin, has found little of note in the work of his famous contemporaries. In his Les choses belles et la vérité, Raisin states, "The critics Lacking and Mérida seem more interested in quoting and analyzing each other than in discussing the texts at hand." The work of Julie and Hunk Hathaway, formerly Hunk Oman, is well known throughout the Western world. Ms. Hathaway's first work of note was her groundbreaking A Pig in Sheep's Clothing, The Life and Times of William Shakespeare, in lieu of a biography. And her study of the novels of Roland Twelves, A Pig in Sheep's Clothing, The Life and Times of Jackson Quintilius Harvey, qualifies her as the greatest Harveyist of the 21st century. Mr. Hathaway first made a name for himself with his 12-volume I Don't Understand and his All the World Needs is a Good Fuck. Since his collaboration with Ms. Hathaway, they have produced 27 critical works in which they analyze a variety of ultra-contemporary works from a purely generalist perspective. Among these is their remarkable The Captain's Verses by J.Q. Harvey, a Laodicean analysis. Despite the zealousness of the devotees of these modern critics, some readers still believe that Benedict Cruz y Pelayo is the only voice of reason in the madhouse of literary criticism. Back to the text. By the next morning, Harvey had become a celebrity in Verona, but he was not interested in the critical value of his work, for his poems had not elicited a single reply from Arianna, and he considered them a failure. He was convinced that though she existed infinitely for him, he existed very little, perhaps not at all, for her. The highs and lows of his love overwhelmed him to the point of exhaustion, and he began to talk to himself. He would say, "Here is where Arianna used to sit, and here she reclined, and here she vowed a speedy return, and here I kissed her." Then he would pretend that she had changed her mind and was coming to see him. Then, as if she really had come, he would gaze at the door. Then, because she was not there, he would fall into despair. One night he went to the Ponte Petra to talk to Sisyphus's cousin, the river Adigeus. Footnote. The Ponte Petra is the ancient Roman bridge that spans the Adige at the north end of Verona. So again, he's talking to Sisyphus's cousin, Adigeus, the river. "You, whose current with gentle murmur glides,
and unhindered make sweet music with the stones, winding with willing sport to the wild ocean. I could be as patient as you, gentle stream, and make a pastime of each weary step, if the last one would bring me to my love. But my steps lead not to her, and I am banished from myself, for Ariana is myself. What light be light, if Ariana be not seen? What joy be joy, if Ariana be not by? Except Ariana be near in the night, there is no music in the nightingale, and unless I look upon Ariana by day, there is no day to look upon. She is my essence, which is but air, empty air, if I am not by her fair influence fostered. O three-faced moon, give me word of my love, though it be with envy you look upon her countenance, gazing over the illuminated fields, considering how to requite the love I display. And thou, O sun, harnessing your steeds that dawn may come and you behold my mistress, I beg when you see her, do not kiss her face, for I shall be more jealous than Othello of the innocent Desdemona. But the river replied not, except with the music of itself. Ah, Harvey sighed, if only my silent words on the page could make music of their own, for then she would be sure to hear them. Yes, that's it, music of my own. I must go to her window and serenade her with such sweet sounds as she cannot refuse to hear. And so it was that Harvey took a guitar to her villa, and settled himself in the garden beneath the window he believed was hers. Then, running his fingers over the strings, and tuning them as well as he knew how, he spat and cleared his throat, and began to sing. Unfortunately, the window was closed, and the animals in a neighboring barn were the only ones to enjoy the ballad, joining in and making whatever music they could. The snorting and mooing grew to such a crescendo that it woke Ariana's father, and he threw a bottle out the window, which hit Harvey between the eyes. Stunned, he collapsed at the base of the villa and was unconscious for quite some time. When he finally came to, he began to sing again, and this time he received his reward, or at least he thought he did, for what he saw was so beautiful he was not sure if he was awake or dreaming. Ariana, he asked the vision above him, is that you? Yes, she said, it is. The happiness which this reply produced was such as Harvey had never known before. Oh, blessed, blessed night, he said. I am afraid that, being in night, all this is but a dream, too flattering sweet to be substantial. Making a rope of bedsheets, Ariana climbed out of the window and walked with Harvey into the fields. They came to an enormous chestnut tree and sat beneath its branches. All the worries of all the people that had ever lived suddenly seemed meaningless. The worries Harvey had experienced when taking on different personalities, whether he was hated or loved, whether he had plagiarized others or not, the pressures Ariana had known, growing up in a small town where women had to be beautiful and proper, the pain of emptiness in a world filled with people longing to find love, the trials of the present and the fears of the future, all of them disappeared. And for one single moment, a man and a woman sat side by side and were content. Harvey felt the sense of fulfillment and loss, as if he had never been alone, unable to remember the emptiness that had been his companion only a moment before. The weight of the world had been lifted from his shoulders, and though neither Harvey nor Ariana knew what their future would hold, how long they would be together, or if their story would go beyond this one present page, for now it did not matter, because they knew
they were where they belonged.
Ariana turned to Harvey and took his hand.
Que carina, manina, she said, and smiled.
My God, he thought, a whole moment of happiness. Is that not enough for the sum of a man's life?